Everybody, welcome to my annual conversation with my dear friend Ray Kurzweil. Ray,
hi.
A pleasure.
Great to be here.
Yeah, for the digital members returning with us, we're together every year at this time to talk about what we're both excited about, what's going on in the world of exponential technologies. First off, Ray, I got to say, those are beautiful suspenders.
Yeah.
Hand-painted, I gather, huh?
They are, yeah. I wear them every day.
So. Yeah. We're up here in Palo Alto, right next to your home at Google. And I just wanted to take a second to say I appreciate all that you're doing. I mean, it's been an extraordinary decade of us working together on building Singularity University.
Yeah. It's been, how long ago did we have that dinner?
I think it's about probably 11, 12 years now. And then, you know, SU came together. I know you've been one of the most important mentors in my life, helped me see the world in a different way. And every year, the world is getting more and more abundant and more power in our fingertips as entrepreneurs.
Yeah, well, you've done a great job of articulating that as well. So.
Thank you. In this conversation, we're going to be turning to your Q&A in a little bit, but I wanted to, Ray, talk about what you're most excited about, what's going on in the field of AI, in the field of really exponential entrepreneurship and what's possible right now. But let's start. When did you start thinking about artificial intelligence? How long ago was that?
Okay. I was about 12.
Okay.
So that's 60 years ago.
60 years. And has it been sort of like a consistent march towards where we are today?
Pretty much. When I was 14, I went to see Marvin Minsky and Frank Rosenblatt. And they were really at the opposite ends of neural nets. Frank Rosenblatt had something called the perceptron, which was a neural net. And it really did not get a lot of respect. And Marvin Minsky was down on it. What I actually found out later is that in 1953, when I was five, he actually invented the neural net. But nobody knew that, because he was opposed to it at that time. If you gave a problem to a neural net, it maybe could handle it a very small amount. It recognized images, so I brought actual hand-cut-out images and showed it to the machine. It got maybe 20% of them correct. But he actually had a keen insight, which nobody had ever done before. And he said, well, if I repeat the algorithm for the neural net and have it overlay itself and do that again and again, it will actually overcome the problems of a neural net.
So get rid of the error rate, perhaps? Is that?
Basically a multi-layer neural net, where it would analyze it many, many times and it would come out with the correct answer. I thought about it. Really wasn't clear to me that would work. It might just reinforce the error rate. And I said, have you ever tried this? And he said, no, he's never tried it, but he really thinks this would solve the problem of a neural net. So that was in 1962 that I met them. 1969, Minsky wrote a book called Perceptrons, where he proved the theorem that a perceptron could not solve various problems, including something called the connectedness problem. So basically, if you see an image, is it fully connected, yes or no? So like an eye has a dot over the rest of the character that's not connected.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the letters are connected. It's a very simple idea. I can explain it to you. People can solve the problem. And a perceptron just could not solve that problem. What wasn't clear about the theorem is that it only applied to a single-level neural net.
Mm.
Did not apply to multi-level neural nets. But the book was very successful in completely killing all funding for neural nets for about 25 years. 25 years later, multi-level neural nets actually began to be used. Rosenblatt died in 1971, 2 years after the book came out. He never tried this idea. It was a really brilliant idea, which he never pursued.
Well, let's fast forward 45, 50 years. So where are we now?
So 25 years later, multi-level neural nets were created. They seemed to work better, but they still weren't really, you give it a problem, it really wouldn't solve the problem fully. And people were very down on it because it just didn't seem to work. What's really key to a neural net is you have to provide it enough computation. Right now they're providing computers with about 10 to the 14th calculations per second. That's about comparable to a human brain.
I have a human brain pegged around 10 to the 16th cycles per second, but what's a couple orders of magnitude between friends?
Well, I said 10 to the 16th in age of spiritual machines. But I'm now saying 10 to the 14th, and Moravec also says 10 to the 14th.
I'll have to update my numbers.
We're coming out now with computers that are in a full, if you put all the chips in, it's like 10 to the 18th calculations per second.
Incredible. Ray, what's happened in the last couple of years that's transformed this?
So we now have enough computation to do.
Is it sheer computational power?
Yes. If you run these without enough computation, they kind of work a little bit. They don't really get there. The computers that defeated Go and chess, mm-hmm. They're at about 10 to the 14th calculations a second, and they just go way beyond humans. In Go, it trained for 3 days and can totally defeat every human. There was nothing particular about Go for that machine. It was just a neural net that just trained with the Go rules. They then just replaced the Go rules with chess rules. In 4 hours, it trained itself to defeat every single human.
So I'm curious, right? Because these are games with a defined set of rules, and there are a lot of things that are games: stock trading, real estate investing.
Right, but it works on everything.
And so the question ultimately is, what are these AIs going to be in a position to just anything and everything?
Then yes, and they're not just limited to games. About a month ago, I made a prediction that we have all these radiology exams where we have the actual exam and the diagnosis.
Yeah.
And we have millions of those. So we could train a neural net that would master that. And we have it, I would assume this would happen in a year or two. Literally 2 weeks later, ChessXNet was announced, 121 layer neural net that completely defeated every
radiologist
that has been shown to. So now they're saying they really have to check their diagnosis with the machine, but there's really no reason to have the human diagnosis at all.
One of the things I think about is there's going to be a time in the near future where it's going to be malpractice not to have an AI in the loop in a diagnosis of whatever it might be, pathology slides, radiological CAT scans.
Ultimately, you don't even need the human being to make the diagnosis. Neural folding, the same neural net was applied to neural folding. And it was compared to 98 other people and machines. It came out first. It got, I think, 25 out of 43 neural nets, whereas the second place only got 3 out of 43. So these are not just games. It's basically anything where we have the rules of how to do it. Mm-hmm. And the machine can actually learn every aspect of the rules.
So, I mean, I think about this, and we've talked about this a bunch. Are we going to see AIs becoming the best comedians? Are we going to have them becoming the best artists? I think about this a lot because, I think I'm of the same opinion of you that we're going to see machine-based learning create almost anything that a human could do. Is there anything that an AI won't be able to do eventually?
Absolutely not. I mean, We do have to master language, and we're not fully there yet. Once we can do a Turing test, we can do humor and every other type of things that we do with language. We're not quite there yet with language. One of the things we don't have is if we speak about something, we don't understand all the implications of it. If I say I took a course at MIT, chatbot's likely to ask me later, gee, have you ever been to college? They don't understand that implication. We have some projects actually in general in the field to do that, which are making progress. And that's why I'm saying 2029 for
Turing. Yeah, I was going to ask you, your prediction famously, we're in 2019, your prediction is that 2029, AIs will reach human level intelligence. That's 10 years away. By the way, I mean, the iPhone came out 12 years ago, so closer to us than the iPhone's origination. So are you still holding for 2029?
Yeah, I mean, I made that prediction in 1999. 1989, I said it would be somewhere between 2005 and 2040, but I said 2029 in 1999.
So what are you going to define human-level AI as? I'm just curious about how you measure that, how you say it has met it. The Turing test is sort of very basic.
No, the Turing test, I think, is great.
You're still holding to the Turing test.
The Turing test, I think it was 1947, Turing described it in just like a couple of pages, and he really didn't actually describe a lot of how you go about it, what kind of human judgment you have, and how long would they have to interview the computer and the layperson. Actually, Mitch Kapor and I wrote some very detailed rules because we made a bet.
Mitch Kapor, who was the CEO, inventor, creator, founder of Lotus 1-2-3.
Yeah. And so it was actually the first bet of the Long Now Foundation, where I said the computer would take a Turing test by 2029. He said no. We both wrote articles why we thought we were correct. But we spent, I'd say, about 6 months defining the rules. And it's probably the best rules you'll find. And it's actually pretty strict. If somebody passes this, they really have passed the Turing test.
So, I'm a big fan of Jarvis in Iron Man. And Jarvis is there having a conversation, asking Jarvis to display this information, asking Jarvis to go out and get this data for you. So at 2029, do we have a version of Jarvis? Do we have our own AI software shell?
Well, yeah. I mean, we have it now. It just doesn't have language. And so we'll add language to it, and you'll be able to talk things over.
But have a conversation and have your AI express an opinion and challenge you in your thinking.
And you'll have to be careful about what kind of feelings it might have when you talk back to
that.
It.
So listen, you and I are both entrepreneurs. We've started numerous companies. A lot of our digital members here are entrepreneurs as well. And when I think about having a co-founder for a company and having a team on your company, are we going to start thinking about starting companies with AI personas and entities that are going to be working with you on your startups? I mean, how do I start thinking about the companies I want to create when we have human-level AI coming online within a decade?
Yeah, I mean, in my opinion, if somebody actually really passes a Turing test, strictly defined, the way I defined it, say, with Mitch Kapor, that person has feelings, it has emotion, it has consciousness, and we'd have to care about what it thought about. So it's not just somebody that you can ignore its feelings when you talk to it.
Amazing. That's fun. So are there breakthroughs required between now and 2029 to get us there? Or is it just more computation?
I actually think we have the computation.
Today?
Yeah. I mean, it's the latest version of advanced computation will be like something like 10 to the 18th calculations.
I mean, the summit supercomputer is like, I don't know, it's like 2.5 million cores operational at the national labs here. Is that the kind of computation, classical, massive amounts of parallel computation?
I mean, everybody's getting access to enough computation to do neural nets because it doesn't work unless you have enough computation.
Sure.
So all the different cloud services are providing that. And I think we actually have enough. There's some algorithms that we need to come up with. Key one is actually understanding exactly what's being said. So when you and I are talking, we have an idea what we're talking about. Later on, we might be able to refer back to that. Computers aren't quite there yet.
And this is a lot of the work that you're doing at Google right now.
Well, we're working on language, you know? Yeah.
It was funny, I was walking home the other day, and I went to go push the button for the light to change, and as soon as I pushed the button, it changed instantly. And I thought to myself, I hope the algorithm is happy, because I pushed it at the same time it was changing it. And it hit me, and I said, I wonder if an important part of intelligence and future AIs are emotions, or that to have reinforced emotions of happiness and anger and fear and love and those sorts of things.
I think that's going to come with the Turing test, to actually understand the nature of language and actually have a response to it. Mm-hmm. It's a philosophical question. It's not a scientific question.
For
it's
sure.
Not, well, some people believe it's scientific, that you can actually test something, is it conscious or not. But there's really no way that you can test something to see if it's conscious.
So this was where I'm going to go next. You know, do you believe that these neural nets, these artificial personas, will develop consciousness? Let's talk about that, and let's talk about the AI as the destroyer, as the negative, the dystopian version. Versus, I think you and I err on the positive side. And how do you answer if someone says, "My God, it's going to be, it will destroy the world"?
I mean, the idea of a future computer is very often negative. We've seen that in every futurist movie.
Mm-hmm.
And usually some band of humans go up against the AI. The AI is like one thing and they have a struggle. The human being somehow manages to win, and that's the end of the movie. What you and I have seen, we both documented how technology progress is making everything better in terms of human well-being. Everything you measure about human well-being gets better, whereas people believe it's gotten worse. So take, for example, the impact of technology on poverty. So people, 23,000 people in 24 countries were asked, has poverty gotten better or worse over the last 20 years? 70% said it had gotten worse. 12% thought it had gotten somewhat better. Only 0.5% said it had actually fallen by 50%, which is the correct answer.
Mm-hmm.
And there's lots of polls showing that people think things are getting worse, whereas they're actually getting dramatically better.
We have a negativity bias. Yeah.
Over the decades and over the centuries. And we have really no idea how terrible life was even a century ago.
Yeah. It's fascinating, right? Because our current economic models don't measure anything accurately. They don't measure the fact that a kid in Tanzania with a smartphone has millions of dollars of computational capability in their hands. It's crazy.
And the barriers between being well off and not being well off, we're overcoming them all over the world, because people in Tanzania have smartphones, and we're creating a much better world in every single measure of human well-being.
That's incredible. About consciousness, do you think we'll actually have a conversation around computers being conscious and computers having rights, individual rights?
Well, they'll definitely take that position.
They will.
And they'll be very smart.
And so they'll argue their case.
So you won't want to get them annoyed at you. But I believe they will be conscious. It's not a scientific barrier. There's no sort of scientific version of consciousness that you can propose that that you can't argue with. Mm-hmm. So it really is a philosophical viewpoint. But they will definitely act conscious. They'll have all the kind of secondary features that we associate with actually being conscious.
They'll have an opinion, perhaps an ego. They'll have desires.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So 2029, we're famously now maybe at Singular University, and you're there with Mitch Kapoor, and you're about to have the settling of your bet. You put forward some friends from Google, perhaps. Maybe they're from Amazon. Maybe they're from Apple. Who knows? And they say, okay, we have our computer. Let's test them. And you go through the test, and you win. He pays you, was it a dollar? How much was it?
No, it was $10,000 going to a charity of your choice.
Maybe you give it to XPRIZE. So human level AI is determined. A year later, 2 years later, 5 years later, where has that collection of algorithms evolved to?
Well, I actually created a movie where the first Turing-capable computer actually emerged in 2033.
Okay.
So I actually lost the bet. But I mean, by his point of view, this isn't going to happen for thousands of years.
Oh, really? He's that negative about it. Okay.
Yeah. So he's not saying, oh, it's going to happen in 2033 or 2039. I mean, he believes it's just really impossible. Hmm. I think the algorithms are actually fairly, the basic algorithms are fairly well known. There's a very active depository of papers and so on that describe the best algorithms. As I think about the key algorithms that have pushed things forward, they're really all in the literature. Mm-hmm. And Google publishes a lot in the literature.
But we're during this exponential period of growth, and I like to say that the rate at which technology is accelerating is itself accelerating, and it's an extraordinary. But those AIs are going to become not just human level, but 10x and 100x and 1,000x. Yeah. How quickly are we going to see that kind of growth?
I mean, when a computer can do something, it goes way beyond what humans could do. So we have talk to books. Mm-hmm. So you put in a question, our software will read 120,000 books, which is 500 million sentences, and give you the best sentences that answer your question. So you can say, what's the value of music, or practical questions, any kind of question that you want, and we'll read 120,000 books and give you the best five sentences that answer your question. It does that in 1 second.
That's pretty good.
I mean, it takes me hours to read 120,000 words. So that's just way beyond what humans can do. And it actually does understand the question, understands the 500 million sentences, and is able to figure out the right way to do it in 1 second. That's just way beyond what humans can do. Now, there's certain things it can't do, but what it can do, it does at fantastic speeds.
What's the world of computers, programming computers, of AIs programming and creating better algorithms for AIs? What are we seeing going on there right now?
Well, everybody does that. We don't have to actually, people create systems that 10 years ago would have taken years, and they do it in a matter of minutes because they've got lots of ways of plugging in various sub-parameters.
Yeah.
So that happens normally, and that's one of the reasons we're making faster and faster progress.
So let's talk about another field that I love, I'm fascinated, you have a prediction in, and I'm tracking this, which is the whole field of brain-computer interface, of connecting your brain to the cloud. Right, so you famously made the prediction that would happen in the mid-2030s.
Yeah.
Early mid-2030s, thereabouts? Do you have an actual number for it? Should I call it the mid-2030s?
The early 2030s, yeah.
Okay, all right, so call it within the next 15 years.
And I'm
years.
Saying by 2029 a computer will pass a Turing test, meaning it will be equal to human in every way that it's now not equal to humans. And in a lot of ways, it's far beyond humans. Because, I mean, these systems today can play games, for example, way beyond what humans can do. And not just games, things like neural folding and so on.
And they're also, I mean, we're seeing artists, we're seeing artistry, we're seeing music, we're seeing symphonies being produced by these.
Yeah, I think that's at a level of passing the Turing test. I don't think we're going to see great symphonies until, you know, 2029 or 2030.
So
then I'm saying, how do we relate to this? And in my view, it's going to be like every other technology. Every other technology helps human beings, like the building we're in. Could we build that with our bare muscles? No, but we have muscle extenders that enable us to create skyscrapers. And we have already brain extenders, which we carry around in our pockets. We couldn't do our jobs without that. And so this is going to be a brain extender, and it's going to literally interface with our brain. Now, the neocortex is organized in layers. There's about, about 100 layers to analyze one situation we're looking at. It's actually a diagonal, so it kind of goes up. As you go up the layers, each one gets smaller. The very top layer has the most significant aspect of understanding a particular situation. That's the layer, maybe that one and a few other layers right at the top need to be connected to the cloud. And we kind of understand what, how to interface it to the cloud. We don't really have the capability yet. There are some projects that are actually trying to do that. They're not quite there yet. I wouldn't put them in my brain yet.
So, I mean, I'm in one of my areas I do track and I report back on a regular basis is where we are in BCI. I've been tracking what has been going on at Facebook. Obviously, Neuralink, the announcement made by Elon, though I have to say they're in primates and they plan to be in humans within roughly a year. And I love the example. They built a special robot to go and actually cut into the scalp, drill into the skull, and then place in the chipset and the connections. And they said they want to make it as simple as LASIK surgery, as quick and simple. It's a good analogy. I like that. But you're not ready to have holes drilled yet.
No, and I think they'll probably do that with people that really need some...
Yeah, cervical fractures and all.
Example, if you really can't communicate outside your body, that might be a good way to do it. Ultimately, I don't think we need to go inside the brain. We put these nanobots in our bloodstream. They go into our brains. They'd find the right place and kind of insert themselves. And they really just need to interact with the top few layers of the neocortex and basically just bring it out to the cloud. It doesn't need to do anything inside the brain. It basically needs to figure out what's going on there, bring it out to the cloud, and also then bring the cloud computation back into your brain.
I'll tell you, one of the companies I'm really excited about, one of the investments that my venture fund, in fact, well, I'll make a promise, one of our upcoming webinars, I'll do it with Mary Lou Jepson, who runs a company called Open Water, and let's go to her lab and we can interact with her and see the technology. But she uses red laser light and holography to actually measure the state of, to interrogate and then influence neurons. And that is the way she wants to read and write, because red laser light goes through the scalp, through the skull, through the brain tissue.
Yeah, some of the problems with these is that they're very slow. Mm-hmm. I mean, the amount of computation that takes place in your brain is actually at very high speed. And a lot of these things, the amount of information you get is very, very slow.
Yeah. Neuralink had their initial system they want to do is about a 2 gigabit per second speed, which is decent. Well, I mean, for reading,
it's
writing.
Good, it's good comparing to what other people will do, but it's still very, very slow.
Compared to the brain as a whole.
I mean, ultimately, we want a very high-speed connection.
By the way, please get your questions ready. We're going to be going to your questions in about 5-10 minutes, and a chance for you to ask questions of myself and of Ray, any of these areas. Ray, you know, you and I are very passionate about longevity. It's a field where we both study and track what's going on in senolytic medicines and Wnt pathway and stem cells. Anything in particular that you're of late tracking?
Yes, I mean, what has just happened now is we have the ability to apply AI to biotechnology.
Yeah. For protein folding, for all kinds of things.
Protein folding, there was actually a very significant thing at a place called Flinders University. They wanted to find the ideal flu vaccine, so they had and basically the idea is to actually have a biological simulator that will simulate what happens in the body. So they had a biological simulator that basically simulated every type of biochemical that would influence protecting you from flu. It came up with several trillion different applications with different chemicals.
I could just imagine the NIH graduate students going one at a time to check a trillion different options.
Then they had another simulator that actually evaluated each one. So each one was evaluated, and they came up with the best one.
Is this adversarial networks, essentially?
Something like that.
Yeah.
But they basically came up with the best one. And they're now testing it and getting good results. Ultimately, we won't really need to test these things. That's a really key thing. I'm on a biotech company. We send out a run, which is basically something to be tested with humans. We get back the results a year and a half later.
Crazy. At huge expense.
And it's just like testing something on the computer, except you don't get your results 2 hours later. You get it a year and a half later. Yes, at cost of hundreds of millions of dollars.
Yeah.
That really slows down the process, because you can't make your next step unless you get that result, and you're waiting a year and a half to get it. If you could then test it on a biochemical simulator that actually simulated human responses in an hour, the progress would be dramatically faster. So that's what's happening. That's what's going to be ahead for the next 10 years, is to be able to do these things with a biochemical simulator, both to simulate what will work and then to evaluate each possible result.
Yeah, that's amazing. You and I both love entrepreneurship as a means of changing the world. We both started numerous companies, when I think about if I were an entrepreneur, we have many entrepreneurs with us today, are there any particular areas that, you know, that if you were starting fresh, where you would go? Is there areas that you'd be excited about pursuing?
Well, it would be in AI. It'd be similar to companies I've started in the past, which is we have a lot more computation now and a lot more data. So we can make a lot more rapid progress. I would be actually very interested in applying AI to biotech, mm-hmm. To be able to simulate biology. If we could actually simulate biology, you could test things out, you know, in an hour rather than a year and a half. And that's where we're headed.
Yeah, I'm one of my friends, a guy named Alex Zvorenkov. He's the CEO of In Silico Medicine. They've been using adversarial networks to create new medicines in silico, and then actually building the molecules and testing them and getting a tremendous result. So it's you know, we talk about heading towards longevity, escape velocity. I mean, this is sort of some of the techniques that we're going to see.
Well, that's what we're going to see for the 2020s, and I believe we'll largely overcome not all but most biological problems with this approach.
Yeah, it's incredible time.
Then in the 2030s, we'll get to nanotechnology, which is a whole different.
And then the future starts looking pretty interesting. I mean, we really are redefining what it means to be human. We're redefining society, the structure of society in so many ways.
And our own body.
Our own body.
I mean, if you think about it, we've got lots of organs in our body. What do all of those organs do? They either, aside from the heart and the brain, they either put things into the bloodstream or they take things out. That's basically what every organ does. Your lungs put in oxygen, take out carbon dioxide. Kidneys take out toxins. Entire digestive tract puts in nutrients. And if you go through the diseases that we suffer from, just take diabetes. It's just a problem with one organ. So one of the, when we get to the point of actually having nanobots created through being able to actually design things atom by atom, they will basically track the amount of all of these different substances in your body. And if something's too high, they'll take it out. If something's too low, they'll put it back in. They'll basically replace all of our organs, aside from the heart and the brain.
And even those?
Well, there's a different way to do the heart.
So please get your questions ready. We're going to be going to the questions in just a moment. The team's going to be prioritizing them. Thank you for being here with us so far. We'll take a 1 minute break and then come back for questions for Ray and myself. Thanks. Your mindset matters a lot. In fact, it's everything. How you think impacts what you believe is possible, what challenges you pursue, and how big you play. In this next decade, humanity is going to be encountering more opportunities and creating more wealth than we have during the entire past century. And if you're stuck in a linear and scarcity mindset, you'll miss out on the most extraordinary time ever in human history. Abundance Digital is the way I mentor and support exponential and abundance-minded entrepreneurs like you. There are five specific ways in which Abundance Digital can deliver you value. First, it's a vibrant and global community where you can share ideas, find co-founders, and others who share in your massively transformative purpose and your moonshots. Second, I host 4 live webinars every month, about 50 a year, inspiring webinars where you can ask questions and drive the conversation. Third, we've built an incredibly powerful app where you can share your ideas with like-minded members and get regular exponential updates directly from me. Fourth, you'll join me via live stream for all 3 days of Abundance 360, my CEO summit, as well as the SU Global Summit and Exponential Medicine. And finally, I've recorded over 100 videos teaching you all about exponential technologies. It's a Netflix model, all you can consume in a fun and understandable fashion. Subjects like autonomous cars and flying cars, exponential energy, CRISPR, longevity, quantum computing, virtual reality, and the future of 3D printing, just to name a few. If you care about the work I'm doing through the XPRIZE Foundation and Singularity University to bring about a world of abundance, then this is a way you can get involved and provide me your support. I truly hope you'll join our abundance community. Thank you. So welcome back. Now it's time for your questions. So Bree, let's begin.
All right, this one's from Tim for Ray. As an inventor, when do you think we'll rely on AI for invention? Is that already happening? How do you view the concept of AI and creativity?
Great question.
Well, when we use AI, a lot of the very detailed programming is actually done by the machine. So in a way, we're really collaborating with AI to do anything with AI. And each year, we have more and more sophisticated tools that allow us to do that. So we're definitely collaborating with AI. And AI can solve certain problems that we give it. I think by the time we get to 2029, it'll basically do everything that humans can do. And the only way for us to keep up will be for us to actually combine with it. So that's the purpose of my idea of actually having nanobots that connect our neocortex to the cloud, so we'll, then our thinking will be a hybrid of biological thinking and non-biological thinking. But it's the non-biological thinking that's going to grow, so over time we'll become mostly non-biological.
Bri?
Great. This next one is from Greg. What similarities do you see between humans and computers? Does it make sense for computers to be modeled after the human brain? Is the human brain a good baseline of intelligence?
Yeah, that's a good example. In my book, How to Create a Mind, I describe a thesis for how the human brain works. There's some aspects of that which we'll use, but our future computers are not going to be just a copy of the human brain. We already have neural nets that can go way beyond what the human brain can do already today. You give it like a game of Go or game of chess or neural folding and all kinds of things that are not just games, where it goes way beyond human beings. And that's today. And that's not actually a copy of neural nets. People say that neural nets are actually a copy of human brains, but actually it's not. With a neural net, you have back propagation, and that's really the key philosophy. It basically it goes over the information again and again, measures how different the current estimate is to the final estimate, and basically narrows narrows the difference. That actually does not take place in the human brain. There's no back propagation in the human brain. We have a completely different way of doing things. So I think we'll actually have a combination of both. So it's not just going to be a copy of the way the neocortex works.
Great. This one's from Gary. It's two parts. For both of you, space, time, aging. Mm. Are any of these potentially reversible? For Ray, if so, when?
I'll take it first. So time, I'm not putting any bets on time being reversible. I'm not sure what you mean by space being reversible, but aging, I do think so. I just finished reading a great book called Lifespan by Dr. David Sinclair. You may have seen him recently on one of our Abundance Digital webinars. And David's going to be coming to Abundance 360 along with Ray this January, which is going to be a lot of fun together. And David's information theory of aging, he's pretty confident that it will be reversible, that increasing the levels of NAD in your plasma and your serum will allow the sirtuin genes to both correct DNA damage and regulate at an epigenetic level. And the belief is that that information error is what's causing aging. So listen, if we're going to find out how we reverse aging, my guess is at some time in the next 20 years, which means don't die from something stupid in the interim.
I mean, there's various things that make us older. They're all ultimately reversible. If you ask how long does a car last, people might say, well, it should last you 10, 15 years. But we have cars that are 100 years old. And the reason we can do that today is we understand everything about a car, and so we can fix everything that goes wrong. We have some very good ideas of what's causing aging in human beings, but we haven't fully perfected that. I believe over the next 10 to 20 years, we'll understand how aging works and be able to reverse it. There's no reason why we can't live forever. Ultimately, our thinking is actually going to go from our biological brain to a non-biological brain. That's a whole different issue as to how you can keep that going forever.
So there you got it, 20 years, at least within 20 years.
Great. Next one is from Lisa. On the future of learning, a lot of schools don't allow tech in the classroom because it's considered to be cheating. Mm. Should computers be banned in K-12 classrooms? How do you think AI and technology will change early education?
Should I take it?
Yeah, go
first,
ahead.
I'll take it. And, yeah, so I've got two eight-year-old boys, Lisa, and I think that the world they're living into is one that will become indistinguishable from the technology world. I think technology is going to become part of the fabric of our lives, and technical literacy and technical fluency and integration is going to be an important part of the world. Of course, any one of us can disconnect any time, but we don't, right? Technology allows us to, you know, do more with the time that we have and the money that we have. We're all born on this planet with the same 24 hours in a day, 7 days in a week, 365 days in a year. It's how you use your time that differentiates the rich and the poor, the capable and the not. So I think ultimately it's going to be interesting. I remember when I was growing up, my dad did not want me to have a calculator when I was in junior high school because he wanted me to learn the basic math. But at the end of the day, what I ended up doing was I learned the basic math, but I used the calculator to program so I could do even higher level functions than I would have been able to do without it. So I, for one, think that banning computers from the classroom is something that is not going to make sense for where the world is going. Ray, I'm curious.
It doesn't make sense at all. I mean, we're training people to actually go out and solve problems. They're definitely going to have all their equipment with them. And we have to solve it, you know, with our equipment. But I remember back when I was at MIT in 1965 and 66, our tests were open book. You could bring any book you wanted or any kind of electronic tool. You had an infinite amount of time, as long as you could actually be there. But you could actually go out and get a meal and come back. And finally, you'd hand in your test with access to every kind of problem you had. But the questions were quite difficult. You didn't get the answer from a book. You had to use the information from a book to try to solve the problem. And that clearly should be the case today.
Bree.
Great. Next one is from Charles for Ray. Why do you choose to spend your time at Google versus any other company?
That's a great question. I'm curious. I was there when you actually got your first job. We can tell that story.
Well, I think my experience of Google is it's a very open place. People are free to put their findings in the literature, and I find it kind of an open place to appreciate what's happening in computers. And I find the way people treat each other to be valuable. So, and it's, they support my working on books and communicating my ideas to the public. So I find it a very good place to work.
Yeah, Bree?
Great, next one's from Will. For both of you, what do you think about the future of food and things like vertical farming?
Well, the kind of phenomena we've seen with electronics, where everything gets cheaper every year by a very dramatic amount, by like 50%, has not actually applied to things like food and things outside of electronics. That's going to change as we approach, particularly as we get to 2030, in the 2030s, everything is going to actually have this deceleration of price. Food is going to become cheaper through vertical agriculture, and really all the things that we need will become very inexpensive. So the amount of money that the government provides, right now the government provides money if you don't have anything. It's not enough to actually live well, but that actually will become quite comfortable to actually live quite well without actually making money as we get to the 2030s.
Will, I just finished my book, which comes out this January, called The Future is Faster Than You Think. It's a chapter I have on agriculture and food. And there is a significant number of things going on. So yes, vertical farming, and it's not just vertical farming, it is it's enclosed farming. And some of the work is going on in the Middle East right now, in Saudi and Abu Dhabi, where you're taking, you know, below ground or enclosures, and you're providing the plants the perfect spectrum, 24 hours, 7 days, micronutrients, no pesticides, and you're getting tremendous output per cubic meter of quote, farmland. The other area that we're working on and getting ready to launch an XPRIZE on this, dear friend, part of our community, Tony Robbins, is part of this as well, is a cellular farming. So instead of, you know, right now, what is food? Food is taking the energy from the sun, the photons coming down, hitting a chloroplast in a leaf, creating a carbohydrate, and then the cow eats that, and then you grow an entire cow, then you eat a steak, right? It's a very inefficient process to get you there. Imagine instead you grab a stem cell from the cow and you grow the steak in the lab, except the steak tastes better, it's from a, you know, Kobe beef, whatever it might be, it's healthier for you, and it's much cheaper, and it's manufactured in downtown Nairobi, Abu Dhabi, Manhattan.
And no animal suffering.
And no animal suffering. And by the way, when the environmental impact is huge, right? 1/3 of the non-ice landmass of the earth is used for livestock. And like over half of our food output goes to feed animals. So it's not sustainable as we're creating abundance in the world. We need a new mechanism for feeding the world. And so we're heading that way, for sure.
Next one is from Jamie. How do you think we can make AI less intimidating to the public? Why does AI always find itself in a public relations crisis?
That's a great question.
Well, it'd be good to know what the crises are, because people use AI constantly and get a great deal of satisfaction from it and get their work done.
I think she means that we're afraid of what we don't understand or what we don't know.
It's, yeah.
Some level of ignorance, I would say.
But it's not... I'm not aware of actual problems that people have, because it's not preventing them from using AI.
I think it's more like Elon saying AI is going to be the great, you know, destroyer. It's the fear hyping that occurs.
Yeah. I mean, there is a danger to that. I mean, to nanotechnology, to biotechnology, to AI, you can certainly imagine people doing great harm with it. I mean, you could have an AI go and destroy a lot of things, destroy a particular type of person. I mean, that's feasible. But that's actually not what we see. I mean, what we actually see, all of the AI is actually helping people. And that's why we're making the kind of economic progress that we're making. But I mean, there is a danger to AI in theory. But so far, we've totally benefited from the application of AI.
Yeah, you know, one of the things, Ray, that I don't see enough conversation around along those lines is the ethics and morals of AI. It's like, you know, and it's not going on at the government. I remember hearing, like...
There are places where that's done.
Mm-hmm. Are we seeing the Asilomar conferences and
well,
such?
Well, there was an Asilomar conference, which I went to.
You did? May I, 1 second, just by way of background here, back in the 80s, when recombinant DNA was coming online and there was concern about being able to slice and dice genes, there was a voluntary conference where all the biotech
leaders... Yeah, it was actually 1975.
75, okay. Yeah. And that became very famous, where those scientists self-regulated, created their own guidelines, and it was the Sillamar conferences. And so, yeah, I remember.
So we had a 5-day conference which we went to, and there was a result of the conference that we all signed. I wouldn't say that has solved the problem. I mean, a lot of the ideas were, well, if it's dangerous, you should be careful. So, yeah. And a lot of them read that way because we, however, that was also true of the Asilomar Conference for Biotechnology. Mm-hmm. At first, it was not that precise. Then over time, it actually got a lot more precise and actually got baked into law. It was actually a very good process. So we're kind of at the early stages of that with AI.
Okay. Bree?
Great. The next one is from Tyler for Ray. Do you still do work on or with music? As a pioneer in the music industry, how do you see music changing in the future?
I mean, I'm still involved with Kurzweil Music. It's a good brand for picking up instruments from in a keyboard. I think what we'll see, particularly when we get close to being able to do language close to a Turing test, so as we get close to 2029, then I think we'll actually be able to create music. I think it's a comparable problem to actually create music as to create language. And we can do a lot of things with language today, but we can't quite pass a Turing test. It's really the same thing with music. I mean, there are people that can actually create a few bars of music. Something can sound just like Bach or Beethoven for about 20 seconds.
You mean through an AI program?
Yeah,
an algorithm.
But it doesn't actually sustain itself because it really can't get the level of depth that you would get from a longer piece.
Bree, I think we have time for maybe one or two more questions.
Okay, this one is from Jen, kind of a fun one. What do you think about humanoid robots? Should AIs get bodies? Is there a place for them in society?
Ah, that's a fun one.
Well, for one thing, we're going to become a humanoid robot because we're going to attach our neocortex to the cloud. And therefore, if you go out to 2034, a person's going to have a biological brain and a non-biological brain that they're going to be mixed together. But the non-biological part of their thinking is going to grow exponentially, whereas the biological part of their brain is not going to grow. So you go out another 5-6 years, they're going to be almost entirely non-biological. So that's basically an AI, but it still exists with the human body. So that's one way to get there. Otherwise, you could just have an AI and give it a body. Now, it doesn't have to be a human body, and certainly we have lots of robots today that are not taking on a human body. We have a certain reaction to a human body. So I think you'll see humanoid robots growing, non-humanoid robots growing, will become a humanoid robot. We may change what it means to be human and maybe take on aspects of our body that are not humanoid. We'll have a different idea of culture with regard to that.
I'll add 2 points. If you join us in January for Abundance 360, we're going to have the CEO of Boston Dynamics, Mark Raybert, there, and we've seen Mark's robots, both Spot Mini and Atlas, do incredible things. The other area that's interesting is, and Ray is involved in this, we have the Avatar XPRIZE, where we're going to be creating robotic avatars where you can transmit your senses and actions at a distance so that you enter a robot and you, as you move your hands, the robot moves its hands, as you look, the robot looks, as you speak, the robot speaks, and vice versa. So that's an interesting area. All right, time for one last quick question, Bree.
Great, this one's from Thomas. How do you think the way humans relate and communicate with one another will change in the next 10 to 15 years?
It's a good idea, because we actually communicate very slowly with language. And computers, you know, can communicate literally a billion times faster. So I think we'll actually be able to increase our
baud rate.
Yeah. communicate more quickly. And we'll probably generate ways that we can communicate that are different than we do today, not just with language, but by it's really hard to define what it'll be, but we'll figure out a way to communicate far more profoundly.
I'll add to close out. I think a community is probably one of the most important things, and the people in your community and how you converse with them, how you share ideas. That's really it's in that communication, that back and forth, that really invention occurs. I close out my new book, The Future is Faster Than You Think, with a conversation around meta-intelligence, that in a future in which Ray's predictions materialize and my neocortex in my brain is connected to the cloud and your neocortex is connected to the cloud along with a billion other people and we can share thoughts, we become conscious on a new level. And I imagine the ability to know another person's emotions, feelings, thoughts, and to connect with them in the same way that, you know, you and Ray and I are a collection of 30 trillion cells that make me, you, and those 30, 40 trillion cells come together to form a human. If we're able to connect our minds together through the medium of the cloud, I think this portends a new evolution of what the human race might be.
Exactly.
Yeah. All right, listen, thank you so much.
I
always love our catch-up for the year and love sort of tracking where we're going towards BCI, towards longevity, towards AI. And a shout-out to all the Singularity University alums out there. We're grateful for you in our lives. And Ray, all right,
yep.
See you next week at the SU board meeting and next year on our annual chat.
Absolutely.
All right, take care, everybody.